back to the gospel. Man, I promise, I don't think it is possible for you guys to be missing us as much as we are missing you when you go from three shows a week down to one. But we will be back up to two and then three shows very shortly. Remember, you can catch us on YouTube at The Gospel STP. Again, that's on YouTube at The Gospel STP. I'm your host, Zay, the fantasy football fiend. And I have my guy, BK Wins. Holla at the people, BK.
Hey, y'all.
So, yeah, a lot to talk about. Football season's over, but it's still a whole lot of football going on. Basketball, it's almost tournament time. It's just a lot going on. So, a lot to talk about. Let's start out with the good word of the week. What we got first, BK?
Yeah, so wide receiver Deebo Samuel traded by the 49ers to the Commanders for a fifth-round pick. How do you think each team fared in this trade?
Well, when you're the team that is getting rid of a guy that you don't have to get rid of, whatever you get is what you get. So I don't even necessarily think about that team in a sense of did they gain, did they lose, whatever the case may be. Because they basically just wanted to get the money off the books. The thing that I actually look at to kind of grade this trade is what Washington's counterparts did just a couple of weeks earlier, which was grade a fourth round pick for Jonathan Mingo, which exactly, he's no one of note. I'll put it that way. So to be able to get Deebo Samuel, who, when healthy, is a stud, a game changer, a weapon, a Swiss Army knife, if you will, to be able to get that guy for a fifth when your counterpart in your same division gave up more for much less, I don't think you could have hoped to start your offseason off better if you're Washington Commander.
Well, I'm all smiles on this trade because Washington fleeced him in this deal. You know, you literally got, and I know the big thing with Deebo is can he stay healthy? And he's had a history of injury trouble, both in college back to his Carolina days. And of course, in the NFL, it's been the same story. But when on the field, he's really, really, really dynamic. He's going to help an already really good Washington offense. And the fact that you only had to give up a fifth round pick for that kind of talent, to me, I look at it as it's worth the flyer, right? The risk is virtually nothing, and the reward could be tremendous. So, and let's be honest, if I reverse this and I were to say, because I know you use the measuring stick comparing what other teams did in a given move, what I look at is what's the reasonable outcome of a team drafting in the fifth round?
Exactly.
How many players are going to be available in the fifth round this year that are better than Deebo?
None.
And the answer is,
there may be a few that end up being better, but good luck trying to figure out which one it's going to be. Because if you knew that, they would have been drafted in the second, third round.
Right. I'm going to say that from a talent standpoint, you said that perfectly. In a perfect world, I think that yes, down the line, it could turn out maybe there are two or three players that surpass what Deebo is. But I'd much rather have Deebo and just throw away the fifth round pick. Like, to me, that seems like a steal. I think Washington won this trade easily. I give them an A.
And for me, I'm questioning why the Patriots didn't give up a fourth round pick. I mean, you have no one of note at wide receiver right now. You keep screwing that up in the first round, and you could have given up a fourth round pick. And as long as I'd rather bet on his health than on our drafting in the fourth round. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like it's 1 + 1 is equal to 11 here. Like, if that's all you had to give up to get him, and everybody knew it was available. Matter of fact, the 49ers told him to go seek a trade. So did you just not pick up the phone, or did the 49ers just not have a working relationship with you and would prefer to take a fifth from somebody else? Like, other than that, and then even a fifth round pick from New England would be a higher pick than the Commanders pick. So if even if you were willing to give up a fifth, they should have theoretically been more willing to do business with you than with Washington. So it feels like several teams fell asleep at the wheel with this one. There's plenty of teams that need wide receivers that if that was the going rate and you have the cap space, like there's no prize for saving money at this point in the game. So, yeah.
Well, speaking of trades and landing spots, all hope is not lost, buddy, because you might be able to land another receiver because 'tis the season to request a trade. Star receiver DK Metcalf, his request formally requested a trade with the Seahawks. The Seahawks asking price is a first and third round pick for him. Also complicating the matter is he only has 1 year left on his deal and looking for an extension. What do you think the landing spots are? I know we're not surprised that he is requesting a trade because, again, that's 'tis the season. But where do you think the best spots are? And what do you think ultimately will be the what will the Seahawks land for him?
Well, first of all, let me reverse that and answer this first. People in hell want ice water. They ain't getting it. Ain't no way nobody about to give up a first and a third for a person that got 1 year left on the contract.
That was a bad time to take a drink. That was a bad time to take a drink. We almost had a mess. My bad. I should know better.
Like, no, really? A first and a third? Are you? Come on. You might as well say we really want to keep him so we hope we can work out the money with that asking price. Because even if you allow him to go find his own trade partner, no one's going to be like, yeah, we'll. I'd be surprised if someone gave up a second round pick. Because one more year from now, and you guys are already on the outs from each other, you're not going to franchise tag him so I can get him for free. Like, why would I give up a first, a third, and the amount of money that it's going to cost to keep his services going forward versus just waiting a year and just paying? Like, that's not going to happen. I think they'll end up getting, if they get a first, it'll be a team like Buffalo who comes in the umpteenth hour, and they have a pick that's at the tail end of the first round, and they have a significant need for a wide receiver. So that's the type of scenario that I could see working out well. Best landing spots? Well, I just said one, Buffalo. The Chargers, they need a wide receiver. They need a number one wide receiver. Ladd McConkey is a beast. He can't do it by himself. They need another guy out there that's a true stud. Quentin Johnston has improved, which it would be difficult to not improve from his rookie year. So there is that. So someone else may be willing to kind of finish that project and see if he comes to fruition at all. And maybe Green Bay, I heard Green Bay was willing to offer a pick and a younger receiver, probably Wicks, who is a stud in his own right. So maybe it's addition by subtraction, depending on how that can work out. Tennessee needs another wide receiver. New England needs a wide receiver. Those are the teams that I kind of feel like would make the most sense, but I don't see any of them giving up a first and a third. Most of them I can see, whether bad, good, or indifferent, leaning on their own drafting skills and drafting a wide receiver in the first round before they pay a first and a third. I can see them drafting the wide receiver in the first and third round before they give up a first and a third for a wide receiver. And that's any team. Like, they, unless your GM is just basically saying, I don't know how to do my job. And don't hear what I'm not saying. I'm not saying some teams with their track record, New England, wouldn't be better off getting a guy that at least you know what's coming to the table because you can't seem to draft well at certain positions, but I just don't see anyone actually doing it. That's a huge pill to swallow when you could probably give up something in that same neighborhood and get somebody like a Myles Garrett, who's going to be way more important than that caliber of wide receiver. Not to mention the fact that DK Metcalf hasn't exactly panned out to be the superstar stud wide receiver that we thought he was going to be. So a first and a third, too rich for my blood if I'm a GM.
Yeah, I think you outlined that perfectly, because not only with the teams, but, you know, given the money that you'll pay, it's so easy to draft a wide receiver.
Yeah.
So now, what do I think the best case Seattle could land from this? They could probably get a first round or a second round pick for him, but they're certainly not going to get two picks for him. And I think it goes back to what you said in the opener, which is, if that's truly their asking price, and of course we can ask for whatever we want. I mean, I can ask for somebody to buy me a Lamborghini. It doesn't mean it's going to happen. And I can assure you it won't. But if it does, I won't complain. Feel free. But nevertheless, I don't think the Seahawks are too eager to move him. I think they're to just punt it forward till next year and see where they're at then. Because they're under no obligation to trade him. Just because he's under contract. So just because I want a trade doesn't mean that you get a trade. Nope. So I think in Seattle is one of the organizations that's better than most about knowing when to make moves and when to pull the plug and when to hold on. And I think that they're just kind of doing due diligence and seeing what they can get. If an offer wows them, they'll do it. If not, we'll just ride it out.
They theoretically have 3 more years that he can be on the team, and there's nothing that he can do about it. So unless you wow me, I'm in no rush. And the pickle that he's put himself in is, if I don't ball out this year, if they don't trade me, then it lessens the odds of any other team paying me what I was asking them for. Mm-hmm. So even if I feel some kind of way about the way they've been treating me in my own mind, I still got to go out there and ball out, or I'm not going to get from anybody what I think I'm currently worth. So, the team is in a good spot here. They can hold his feet to the fire for 3 years and say, hey, perform, and either we'll pay you or somebody else will. But if you don't perform, we'll probably be offering you the largest contract that anyone else is offering you, because we know why you weren't performing versus other people just saying, we don't know if you can.
Mm-hmm.
Next up, ACC settles the lawsuit brought by Florida State and Clemson. And this one, I want to let you attack first, because I know Florida State is near and dear to your heart, and you keep your, you know, ear to the ground on all things dealing with said team. So what's your overall outlook on what's going on with those two teams, the aftermath of the lawsuit? Is everything hunky-dory now? Kumbaya, s'mores? Like, what are we doing?
Well, both universities came out and said the right things. You know, so from an optic PR standpoint, they played nice in the sandbox. The ACC, to their credit, also said the right things as well. But I think this is while it's a win for the ACC that it's now settled and they can move on, which is important to them. And they were also able to keep both teams for the time being, so that's also a win. I think it's a bigger win for Clemson and Florida State, and here's why. In the short term, it's a win. Because ultimately, Florida State and Clemson both got what they want, which is the argument they made is based on the revenue that's coming into the ACC and distributed to each of the universities shouldn't be held equal. You know, the three biggest programs in the ACC in terms of generating dollars is Clemson, Florida State, and North Carolina.
Yeah.
And North Carolina is the only one that does it outside of football. They're doing it in basketball versus the other two do it in football. But I say that to say that ultimately, while I think that it's a win for both because it's settled and they can move on, and Florida State and Clemson both are going to get additional money that other universities likely won't, so they'll be compensated and rewarded for their brand, which makes sense, right? Much like a college football athlete, a college athlete should get the NIL and get compensated for their name, image, and likeness, right? Same with the brand for the universities. But I'm going to take this one step further, and it's what you and I have talked about before. And I ultimately think there's no way of getting around this. Not today, tomorrow, next year, or even the year after that. But ultimately, you're going to see two super conferences, because you're going to see the ACC still win in terms of revenue. While we delayed the outcome or the inevitable, these teams aren't going to compete with the Big Ten and the SEC in terms of revenue. And ultimately, they're all going to merge into two big conglomerates. I can't envision a scenario where it doesn't happen like that. So I think we're delaying the inevitable.
My thought was, doesn't really matter. Within 5 years, the conference is dead. So like, get paid while you can, seeing as how you're the main attraction for the conference. It won't mean much in 5 years. It'll be a situation where there'll be two super conferences. And I'm going to pose a question that there's no way you could prepare for, because I just thought about it. But does Clemson, Florida State, or Notre Dame fold first? What I mean by that is Notre Dame's situation is different. They aren't in a conference. Clemson and Florida State are in a conference that they've outgrown, and there's no one else even close to them. So in order for them to really maximize their revenue, they would actually be better off in another conference, or getting such an unfair proportion of the totality of the school's income within the ACC that the other schools will want out and just kind of disperse amongst the super conferences. So I think the ACC is done regardless. But do you think that that situation, the ACC or the Notre Dame individualness, if you will, comes to a close first? Who do you think succeeds to the super conference first?
I think the ACC. I think Clemson and Florida State. And the reason why is because Clemson and Florida State have both been hence the lawsuit. They've definitely put their cards on the table and made it very clear how unhappy they were with how things were set up in the ACC. Notre Dame loves their situation. People keep coming to them to join their conference, like the Big Ten, the ACC specifically. Both those conferences have numerous times approached them. And Notre Dame loves life as they have it. The landscape in college football would have to tremendously change for them to reconsider their position.
I agree. And what solidified that is the fact that they made it to a championship this year. The new setup makes it as such that if their coach is going to stick around as the head coach, they're pretty much going to be in the playoffs every year. Because you have to be outside of the top 12 now, possibly 14 to 16 in a year or two from now. Notre Dame isn't used to finishing outside of that, which means theoretically every year they have a shot at a championship. You've taken away, by having that sort of a playoff with that amount of spots, the need for that team and only that team to not need a conference. Now, when there's only two super conferences, would they possibly freeze them out and saying, hey, if you're not a part of one of these conferences, I don't care if you're undefeated, you can't be in the championship, because it is not your schedule won't be able to be as such that your strength of schedule will be good enough to beat the other teams that are here, because we won't allow you to schedule enough of us for your schedule to be good enough for you to get in. So we'll be able to politically say, well, your schedule wasn't good enough, and that's why you couldn't get in. But really what we're trying to do is strong arm you into a super conference. You can pick which one you want to go to. But I kind of think that's where we'll ultimately end up landing. And I'm looking at about a six to 10 year time frame of that all working out, because of the amount of time that I think it'll take for the super conference to really kick in. At this point, Pac-12 is on its last leg. The Big 12 has a lot of teams, but when your two best teams move to the SEC, and now you're kind of, clawing and scratching there with entertainment there, it's just not really ACC. You got Clemson and you got Florida State. But if they keep doing what they've been doing the last couple of years, their cachet won't be as high as it has been as of late. So I don't know. It's definitely going to be interesting how everything pans out. But yeah, I don't think the lawsuit one way or the other is going to prolong the inevitable, but so no. So I'm on the same page with you with that.
Well, rounding out the good word of the week, turning to the NBA, star guard Kyrie Irving suffers a torn left ACL and is out for the year, with Anthony Davis also sidelined and often injured. Does the Irving injury essentially end the Mavs season?
Oh, yeah. It's not essentially. It's most definitely ending their season, to the point where they may not even bring AD back for the rest of the year, just because why? You're basically going to risk him having an injury that'll take a full year to recover from. Like, you just not only is your season this year done, your season next year is done too, because Kyrie is your best player. He won't be ready to attempt to play until around this time next year. So, yeah, good luck with that. And not only that, but with the particular injury that he has, his speed and his quickness is what makes him unguardable in many situations. That particular injury is going to take a little bit of that away. So at the age that he is and with the particular strength of his game, will we ever actually see Kyrie as we've known him again? That's a whole different question and a lot more Debbie Downer-ish, if you will, but couldn't be worse for the Mavs. The guy that you traded for is hurt. The guy that was going to be the anchor of your team when you traded your guy is hurt. And then about four other guys are hurt. So, yeah, this is bad, man. This is all around horrible. This, in the words of Charles Barkley, is terrible. Terrible, man. It couldn't be any worse. And you've won too many games to this point to lose enough games to be in the lottery to get a difference maker in the draft. And I don't even know if you actually still have your first round picks because of other trades that you made. So this is bad. This is all bad. Like, this sets this franchise back. Like, it may be in reset mode at this point. I don't know what their pick situation is, but if they don't have picks and Kyrie isn't the guy that he used to be, and AD can only be the guy that he is part-time because the other time he's hurt, what else do you have? So, yeah, this is go Lakers. That's all I can tell you.
Yeah, they're in a world of hurt. I'm sure that look, it's not the GM's fault that Kyrie got hurt. You can't control that.
No.
But you can control the deal that you made and the way you went about it. And
great deal. That was a great deal. Don't talk about that man for that deal. That was a great deal.
Not if you're a Mavs fan, it's not. As an objective person, Zay, many shook their head at what that GM was doing. And
they didn't want to pay that man $400 million. I understand. You're a middle market team. You ain't got that kind of that's the gross domestic product of medium sized countries in the world. They don't want to pay that man that much money.
I think the issue that I have with it is not necessarily that they made the decision. Like, if you're concerned about him eating his way out of the league or his habits or whatever you decide to justify, or you don't want to pay him or whatever. Look, if you make the decision as an organization that you're going to move on and you don't want to pay him the money or can't pay him the money, I get it. But you needed to open it up to everybody so that you have the best chance of recouping what you can.
No. No, that's a horrible idea, BK. Horrible idea. That's the worst thing that you said since we started recording this show, BK. That's terrible. No, that's not what you do. That's not smart business. It's not smart business, BK. Let me tell you why it's not smart business. And this is objectively speaking, honestly, for real. You're laughing. I'm serious, BK. This is objective. I promise you it is.
Just all I see is the purple and gold glasses that you're having on right now.
No, so okay. All right. Let me paint a picture for you, okay? I'm not looking at your department. I'm looking at the business as a whole. Are there teams, let's say team A, B, or C, I can't give you the exact name or situation, but they were willing to just wow you with a trade. But you'd be sending one of your most marketable guys to a market that doesn't make sense for the company, not for your department in the company, but for the company. So sometimes the best deal isn't necessarily what works best for your department, but what works best for, or the best direction, if you will, is not necessarily what works best for your department, but what works best for the company as a whole. The NBA in the Laker game versus, it wasn't Dallas, it was the one before that. They had the highest viewership of any game, regular season game, in some years. So it's showing you that your international players, your superstars, in most cases, you can kind of bring them into the fold in a small market or middle market. But in order for the game's survival, you need big names on the teams that people want to watch when they have a watchable product. I believe that this was our mulligan for what David Stern did to us when Chris Paul was supposed to be playing with Kobe. Because you would have seen a similar situation as far as output and wins in that pairing as you're seeing with Luka and LeBron. The other thing that it does, believe it or not, again, looking at whole picture, it lengthens the career of your most your first most marketable player, which is LeBron James. He's actually comfortable playing Robin now because he trusts Batman. You can literally see it on the court where these guys are so shocked that there's someone else that they're currently playing with that understood what they saw, and they didn't even have to say it. It was just the perfect setup. You knew what to do, I knew what to do, and it was done. And I can't believe that both of us were on the same page because this hasn't happened before. LeBron has never trusted another teammate as much as Luka before. Luka and LeBron both make the right plays. They're making guys around them. The guy that we were willing to deal Dalton Connect for. I didn't even mean to do that, but you saw what I did there. So the we were willing to send Dalton Connect up the road for a center who's often injured. Meanwhile, Jackson Hayes, with the playmaking of LeBron and Luka, is about to be a superstar. This dude is putting up high-end double-doubles on a regular, and he's just breaking the floor of his ability with these two players. I believe, I haven't spoken with, you know, the agent. I haven't spoken with LeBron's agent. He should give me a call. He hasn't yet. We'll see how that goes. But I'm willing to put my acumen, the namesake of the acumen, if you will, on the line to say that LeBron might not necessarily retire if he feels that his team is still in the championship window. And other players may be willing to actually go there on veterans minimums and things of this nature, knowing that at some point in time, LeBron will go and it'll be Luka's team and whoever else is still there. That trade put the Lakers smack dab in the middle of being relevant and good to great for years to come. And the NBA needs that. Needs that. The NBA needs the Knicks, the Lakers, the Celtics, and two or three other teams. You can figure out who they should be. You got the Spurs that are in the right direction. You got Miami that's never too far off from it. You got Milwaukee. Other exciting teams and teams that you can follow, but there's certain teams that if they aren't up to snuff are in the thick of it. Viewership as a whole internationally speaking, the dollars don't make sense.
Yeah, I agree with all of that, actually. I think from an NBA standpoint, from a big picture, huge. This trade was a huge win for the NBA. For the Lakers, it was a huge win for them. From a Mavs standpoint, there's no way of saying this other than they got fleeced, and it's their own fault. So,
I don't think they got fleeced, though. I really don't. But and let me explain this exactly, because you got that smirk in your face, like, oh, this is some bull jive about to come out right now. No, but seriously, if you didn't want to pay him the $400 million that you were going to have to pay him, and I don't think it's about output, I don't think it's about his weight or anything like that. I just believe that the new regime, remember, that the team is no longer ran by Mark Cuban. And I believe the new regime was just like, I can't see myself paying $400 million to one guy. I don't care win, lose, or draw. Like, I'm not paying one guy almost a half a billion dollars. I'm not going to do it. So when that's the case, and that guy is going to leave his team, he can only go a couple of places. And the Celtics don't have the money to pay him. Where else could he have gone and it would have worked out for the NBA? Can you think of anywhere? I can't really think of anywhere. In any place that has cap space right now, at least.
Yeah, I mean, it would be hard. For sure.
So there really weren't but so many teams. And they tried Minnesota. They weren't willing to give up Anthony Edwards. And it was one other team that they said they tried, and I can't remember who the player was. Do you remember? Did you see that headline at all?
Mm-mm.
I can't remember. It was two other teams. One of the guys was Milwaukee. They tried Antetokounmpo, and Milwaukee didn't want to do it. I mean, who else is out there that's tradable? I don't think the Celtics. I don't know that they would have traded Tatum for Doncic. Different positions, different guys.
I mean,
already a champion and the face of your franchise. Like, who else is?
For the Celtics, you already have a loaded championship team. I don't really know they need to do anything.
So what other team would you be? I mean, I'm really hard pressed to find a team that things would have made sense.
You have me sold when you put it like that.
So, hey, that's all. And that's an objective opinion. That's all I'm saying. Like, if they tried Edwards and Antetokounmpo, and honestly, think about it. They went to the two guys that have seemed to have the most guff, if you will, about their current situation. Remember, Antetokounmpo is the one that came out and said he wants to see every international player in the big market. Anthony Edwards is the one that comes out every time he gets a chance and talks about how trash his team is since Carl Anthony Towns got sent up to the Knicks. So they went after a couple of guys that were disgruntled. Who else was saying that he feels as he's playing out of position and he would rather play the four than the five? It was really the only other superstar that was out there complaining about his current situation, if you think about it.
But you know what he needs to do? Rather than worry about what position he's playing, how about play? The position he needs to find is on the court.
Not my clown, not my show. I couldn't care less at this point whether or not he's back on the court.
Well, that ends the good word. We're going to move over to the truth. A little back to the NFL, Zay. There are 12 teams that have never, ever, ever won a Super Bowl. Those are the Cardinals, Falcons, Bills, Panthers, Bengals, Browns, Lions, Texans, Chargers, Vikings, and the Texans. Which team of these 12 will end their title drought first?
Well, BK, you know I'm never one for following the rules, so I disregarded your which one, and I have like four.
I can't get mad at you because I actually did the same.
Awesome. See? I knew that was going to work out well. So for me, of the teams that you mentioned, the Bills and Bengals are the closest. closely followed by the Lions. If the Lions are all healthy, then they may actually be the closest based on having defense and offense. But Lions, Chargers, Bengals, Bills are the teams that I think, give or take a player or two, are at least in position to be able to do something.
So I have four teams as well. So the Bills, they're right there. In no particular order, but the Bills, the Lions are right there. They proved that last year. They had a terrific year. I realized they lost to my Washington squad. What a great game. But nevertheless, you know, they're right there. The Texans are right there. You know, we didn't talk about it, but they traded for Christian Kirk. So now they have another wide out there. So they just got even, and they're in a division where, you know, they're the huge favorite, heavy favorites to win that division every year.
Yeah.
They have quarterback, coach, their defense is really good. Their playmakers should be healthy. The Texans are really, really close. And then the last team, the Los Angeles Superchargers, you know, the Fighting Harbaughs. What does he do? He gets those teams to win. He adds a couple pieces, parts to help Herbert on offense. And, I mean, I think the Chargers are another team. I excluded the Bengals for a few reasons, even though I definitely can appreciate them being in the mix. I love Joe Burrow. I love Ja'Marr Chase. The problem is their offensive line is mediocre at best. Their head coach, Zach Taylor, is below average at best. And the other part is they can't keep Burrow healthy because the offensive line struggles. Do they lose Higgins? They probably will. And maybe they won't. Who knows? Hendrickson, their star rusher, is gone, you know, or seeking a trade.
And they just lost their best offensive lineman, which isn't great since how you can't keep Burrow healthy. So,
right. So I think being in a really tough division and having those internal challenges, I think it's going to be really hard for them to navigate through that. I can see them doing it, but I think it'd be harder than the other four that I named.
The reason why I have them on the list is because of the teams that are in the AFC, they're the only one that has shown the propensity to be able to beat the Kansas City Chiefs. And as long as Andy Reid is coaching and Patrick Mahomes is the quarterback, you're probably going to have to see them at some point. And the Bills don't seem to be able to get past them. And the Bengals do. So not saying that the Bengals will end up being the better team, but if they're in that AFC championship and they have to be going up against the Chiefs, of all the teams that we've named that are in the AFC from that bunch, I'd put my money on them getting past that particular hurdle, if you will, than any other team in the AFC. So that's the reason I have them there.
No, it definitely makes a lot of sense.
Next up, item
number two. So when selecting both college football and college basketball playoff teams, in a perfect world for you, what should be the criteria?
I kept it real simple, BK. Win-loss record first, strength of schedule second, the eye test third. I know what I'm looking at, even if I can't quantify it. A win is a win, is a loss is a loss. And this is what I changed with strength of schedule. I don't give you a grade for strength of schedule until towards the end of the season, where I see where teams actually are versus giving you credit for beating up on a cream puff because I thought they were going to be good in the offseason. So I believe that would give the perfect conglomeration of stats and not pushing what we see on the field aside for stats. So it's kind of the perfect marriage, if you will. But also, it kind of makes sure that teams can't leave things up to chance. Because you don't know if you're going to take a loss, and because you don't know if one of those fringe schools that may be up, may be down, is going to be up or down, maybe now you just pick a little bit of a more wholesome schedule, if you will. So I think it can be a cure for a few things. And I don't want it to become so convoluted that we go back to not knowing what the heck we're doing.
No, I definitely can see that for sure. So the first thing before I lay out criteria, although I guess this could be part of the criteria, there will be no preseason rankings. Y'all know by now how I feel about this, because it unnecessarily paints a picture that's not usually anywhere near close to being factual.
Yep.
Because it's based on how you did last year, and now especially more than ever with NIL and Portal, you don't know will that continue or how that will shake out the next year. The second thing that you have to be mindful of is, you know, you don't know the recruiting part. You know, recruiters have these recruiting classes that they rank 1 to 25 every year and even beyond that. But how often are the recruiting experts accurate in their assessment of these classes? And the answer is not often. So we're basing these things on intangible things that have no factual relevant value to assessing teams.
Agreed.
As a result, there will be no preseason rankings in college football or basketball to shape this. In fact, in my utopian world for this, there will be no rankings until the committee gets down to the last 4 weeks of the season. The last month will be the first initial reveal of the rankings, 1 to 25. And then at that point, if you beat one of those teams that's ranked 1 to 25, you're going to get credit for beating a ranked team. Not that they were ranked number 6 the first week and ended up 60 by week 8. You know, when you've played enough of the games to know and you played 2/3 of the schedule, it's fair enough for me to evaluate a team at that point, having played 2/3 of the schedule, and say, okay, there's enough data points. This is where we are. Here's the criteria I would use. Your win-loss record, strength of schedule, game control. Were you ahead of most of the, in the, how often of the 60 minutes of the game were you ahead? Did you pull it out at the very end, or were you ahead for the whole game? Because control means you're the better team and more dominant team, and that matters. The eye test for sure, because when you watch these teams play, the eye test matters. You can tell who's a playoff team or not based on how they look over 3 months of body of work. Not one game or two games, but over 12, 13, 14 games, you can see that. The other thing is, who did you play? Who did you beat? And then the last part is, you're going to get bonus points in the formula for true road wins. I mean that more for college basketball, but it also factors into college football, because I'm not going to separate these for purposes of my question or the question. True road wins matter. Not some neutral site game where your Georgia's playing in Atlanta, okay, or Florida State's playing in Florida. A true road game. Georgia went out up to Columbus and took the Buckeyes to the woodshed. That's a true road win. You won in the horseshoe, you should get bonus points for that. So the goal is to play a better schedule, control the games. Better strength of schedule will give you better ranked teams at the end. Were you in control of the games, and how many times did you win on the road? I don't want to see schedules where 9 of your 12 games or 8 of your 12 games are on the road. I mean, at home, sorry. When 2/3 of your schedule's at home, come on now. Especially in the current landscape where half of those you're usually cupcakes. Which is great if you're a bakery, but not when you're trying to select a playoff team. And not I do like cupcakes.
Not mad at that at all. The only thing that I would challenge is the controlling the game. I think there's a space, or there's something to be said for the teams that don't necessarily control the game, but figure out a way to win anyway. especially if this was a game that you weren't necessarily supposed to win. If you're one of those, you know, win one for the Gipper type teams for that year, I wouldn't want to take away the credit that you deserve based on being able to figure out how to win, even if a bigger, better, stronger team controlled the game for most of the game, as long as you won.
Well, you'll still get credit for the win, loss, the strength of schedule, and all of that. So it's not like it'll go for naught.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense.
Well, last but not least in the truth, Commissioner Zay, should Major League Baseball expand or contract teams? And the reason why I'm going to outline four teams for you, the reason why this came into my mind. You know, the Rays and the A's are in awful stadium potential relocation. A's obviously relocating. Rays could be getting there. Who knows? And then also the Royals and the White Sox also have stadium issues that are looming and lurking. And so my question to you is, are you more on the side of expanding to more teams or contracting the league to less teams? Or I'll give you the third, because I know you like to, you know, throw a wrinkle in there and I can see the wheel spinning. Or are you okay how it is now and no change is needed?
Okay, so I'm looking at this from a strictly business standpoint. When you're stagnant or decreasing, you don't expand. I honestly believe there's too many teams and too many games. It's just too much to keep up with. If you're a purist and you've been watching it your whole life, awesome. They've already got your money. They've already got your eyeballs. Most of the rest of us don't even know where to start. So expanding isn't an option, which means the only thing we can do is either remain the same or contract. There are obviously teams that don't even really want to pay their payroll, don't want to build up their stadiums, or are certain situations are calling it such that they can't remain in the place that they're currently in. And if that's the case, and you don't really have the strongest of followings to begin with, what are we doing? Like, at some point, something's going to change in baseball. And unlike several other sports that are either maintaining or expanding, WNBA, for instance, your girl, Serena, just bought the expansion team, or a half partner, an expansion team there in Canada. They have an expansion team that I believe is going to be in, where is it? Was it? I can't even remember what the other location was, but I know hers was in Canada, and there's another one that they're adding on somewhere else. But then they had the one that just came online in Golden State. So, you know, that sport's growing. And it shows by people with deep pockets saying, hey, let me get in on the front end of this before I miss the train that's coming out of the station. When was the last time you heard of somebody wanting to buy a baseball team?
I think for me, the answer to your point, and I'm sure you'll give out my email address later, but I'm very much in favor of contracting. I would, there's too many games. The season's too long. Nobody cares enough. Let me phrase that. Nobody's too strong. The season's too long for the casual fan to maintain interest for the length of time it requires. So while there are the diehard purist fans out there that live, breathe from pitcher catcher reporting to the end of the season, the casual fan, it doesn't maintain that interest. I think if it were me, I would reduce the league by four teams. The Rays and the A's for sure would be gone, and I would do some kind of analysis of the other remaining teams and contract two other teams to be named later. Don't you love the Senator answer? But I think ultimately, if we cut it down to by four teams, I think we're oversaturated with teams.
Yeah.
And there's not enough interest to support it, to your point, from a business standpoint. Less is more. Four teams going bye-bye is overall a win for what's needed.
100% agree. Moving right along, our top five all-time of something. BK, I really enjoyed this one, buddy. Top five for this week. Talk show hosts. And I do have an honorable mention.
I would have never guessed.
Because, and the only reason I have an honorable mention is because I didn't know if the guy that I put there is a talk show host or if this show is considered to be something different altogether that we should rank in and of itself, which we can still do, which is sports talk show. So I didn't know if that was its own thing or so my honorable mention is Stephen A. Smith. Let me put that out there right now. Just because I didn't know. And everybody else is just a regular talk show host. But yeah, Stephen A. Smith is my honorable mention.
Who you got for number five?
Number five, Bill Maher, Politically Incorrect. Absolutely love Bill Maher. We don't necessarily see eye to eye on all subjects, but that's okay because I don't mind having a discourse with someone who doesn't necessarily see some things the way that I do, as long as it's done in a respectful manner and we're both going into it eyes wide open and attempting to learn something from the other party. And most of the people that he has on his show tend to not be cookie cutters of the way he thinks or anyone else who happens to be a guest on the show thinks. So absolutely love Bill Maher and Politically Incorrect. What's your number five?
My number five is Craig Kilborn. Loved when he was on ESPN. Then he went to the comedy show. He just has a unique flair and personality that I find entertaining. So I have him number five.
Okay. Number four for me, Jon Stewart, The Daily Show. Oldie but goodie. He's been on forever. Fair, firm, consistent. And when need be, he can make you laugh at some things that should make you cry, depending on what's going on. So, yeah, Jon Stewart, number four for me. Number four for you.
For me, Conan O'Brien hits number four.
Okay. Not mad at that. Conan and Jimmy Fallon are my two favorite current late show hosts. So
I love it. Number three.
Another honorable mention for me will be Conan O'Brien. Number three, Arsenio. Oh, I just decided to do that on the spot. For my half of the audience that's never seen that show, they're going to think I just lost my mind. But Arsenio Hall, he broke down barriers. I mean, he was one of the first as a black man to do what he did and do it consistently and over a certain amount of time with, you know, breaking down barriers and back-to-back star guests, people that are in the know, people that people wanted to see. And there weren't too many people doing what he was doing when he was doing it. So, yeah, Arsenio Hall, number three for me.
My number three, Oprah. I couldn't imagine having a list and not having Oprah on it.
Agreed.
So the impact she's had in the industry is truly phenomenal. So I have Oprah as number three.
I can't disagree with you so much that she's my number two.
Mm.
So yeah, I mean, that was the first talk show that I actually watched. And the only reason I watched it, to be clear, is because it came on after my grandmother's stories. And by that point in time, we had been out in the hot sun so long that you just wanted to come inside the house to drink a cold glass of water. And you watched whatever was on the TV and you kept your mouth shut so you wouldn't get popped in the mouth for interrupting grandma's stories and soap operas. And as far as grandma was concerned, Oprah was like the extension of the soap operas. We got to make a top five soap operas all the time. It just popped in my head. At any rate, so, but yeah, that's just, I don't necessarily, how would I say? Oprah is another celebrity that I don't necessarily agree with all moves and motives, if you will. But at the end of the day, you can't take anything away from her talents and her ability to be able to put together a show that was game changing. So yeah, definitely number two for me, Oprah Winfrey. What you got up next?
My number two is David Letterman.
Honorable mention, number three.
all time great. You can't talk, for me, you can't talk about talk shows, especially late night talk shows, without Letterman. So he's my number two. And number one, Zay, bring us home for your number one of the week. Who you got?
Ellen. Ellen just did it differently. Ellen was one of those talk shows that it didn't have to be high drama, or it didn't have to be anything demonstrative, or it didn't have to be, you know, me against you or anything like that. Like, a lot of her shows were just stuff that you laughed at from the beginning of the show to the end of the show. There was nothing divisive at all at any point in time. So it was just fun. That's the word I would use to describe Ellen's show. A lot of other soap operas are thrillers or suspenseful or, you know, dramatic. Her show was just fun. What you got for your number one pick, BK?
My number one is, I think many consider the GOAT of talk show hosts, Johnny Carson.
Definitely a trailblazer. I wasn't allowed to stay up late enough to watch Johnny Carson
before.
So I didn't get much Johnny Carson, and I wanted to be as authentic as possible, not going by, you know, popular demand, but by my personal favorites. So I guess he would be honorable mention number four based on popularity and what everyone else has to say about him. So, yeah, that's what he would be. All right, so let's go right ahead into our Can't Miss Weekly Rant. As BK stated on last week, we don't bet on random NBA games, and you're going to have more plays than you can stomach come March Madness, which is right around the corner. So, first, Can't Miss Weekly Rant. You want to go first, or you want me to go first, BK?
Yeah, so I just want to quickly comment on the best bets.
Okay.
So the bad news is we're going to kick the can another week. No plays. We're here to make money. I take that very seriously. No plays this week. Next week, we start into conference tournaments. March Madness right around the corner. Please know and believe the plays will come fast and furious once we get into conference play moving forward. But you guys get another week to rest, count your money and blessings, and we'll get ready to conclude this week's show with the weekly rant. And Zay, I will give you the honors, my good man.
Well, I have a fundamental issue with people that find a reason to down a young black man. I say that because I'm seeing all of these little press clippings and things of that nature about Shedeur Sanders. This young man started out at Jackson State, took them to heights that he'd never seen along with his father. But he being the guy actually on the field, he did that. And they said, he couldn't do that in D1 play. Okay. They moved to a team that won one or two games the last few seasons, turned that team around. And by the end of last year, they had won more games in a single year than they had won in several years combined. Again, more success, but more ridicule. And now that we're going through the interviews and combines and all that kind of good stuff, for whatever reason, a kid that's never gotten in trouble, a kid that has never had issues with anyone on the field other than that one time when the Colorado State quarterback was talking trash and he basically just said, "Yeah, I saw what you said. Yeah, I don't want to shake your hand. We ain't cool. Let's not pretend like we are now, based on what you said about me," which I can only respect. But what I found is that a lot of times when a young black man shows confidence or shows that he understands what he's actually worth, it's frowned upon. And for people to say that he just rubs them the wrong way, or, you know, he's not a leader, or he's not this, that, and the third. There was a particular quarterback coach that said that he was falling down his draft board based on cockiness and things of that nature. I just don't really see the same type things being said about other young men that show the same level of confidence, that show the same bravado, if you will, those same type statements and actions when done by other quarterbacks are actually labeled as leadership and labeled as being fiery and having fire in the belly and all this other. You know how many tablets Tom Brady has broken? You know how many times he was over there fussing or cussing at whoever else? And it was just, oh, it's the fieriness of a leading quarterback. But then you have a young black man do the same thing, and it's, he doesn't know how to, in the words of my guy BK, let's be consistent. Let's be consistent. That's all I'm saying. Just be consistent. But especially when you're talking about someone that has never had an issue, spotlight's been on him since he started playing, and this is the guy that you feel has some character issues? I didn't hear that about your boy Stetson, who was a raging alcoholic, and everybody on this team knew it. No character issues were talked about. But because this guy has confidence in himself, like, please stop the madness. Like, just be consistent. That's all that I ask. BK, what you got?
No, well said, buddy. You know I hate double standards, so that's
exactly.
That's definitely fair. This won't surprise any of you. This is a rant that's not specifically sports related, but you guys all know, and Zay, you know me well enough to know, but all of you out there know me well enough to know over the last year that I usually use this platform at some point to talk about a bigger message or send a message that needs to be sent. Never take anyone or anything for granted. We're never promised anything beyond today. And I say this because I listen to your point, Zay, about the double standards and the vitriol that Shedeur Sanders is unnecessarily getting. But I read political statements from both sides all the time on social media. So you heard me talk a few weeks ago about someone who I think the world of, who lost their son in a tragic car accident a few weeks ago. And over the past week, someone, a member of my team, suffered a very, very serious medical issue and is in the fight of her life. And I bring this up to say, is people, we need to do better and focus on things that matter and stop wasting time on things that simply don't. And I'm going to make this message very, very clear. The thing, if it's not going to matter to you a year or two from now, it shouldn't matter to you now. I understand that politics divides people. I understand that sports teams and fan bases divide people. But at the end of the day, and I'll use me as an example, if I'm gone tomorrow, does it really matter if my team wins? Does it really matter if someone in office does something I don't like? The answer is no, I'm dead. So I need us to do better and focus on the right things, control what we can, and for whatever we can't control, leave it to God. And that's the truth.
That wraps it up for this week. it will be another long week until we get back to you on next Friday. About another week or two, we'll be back with the fantasy show because the NFL year will be open and a lot of moves will be made there that will have fantasy implications. And we will go over a few things that we go over every summer to get you prepared for the upcoming year. And we'll continue to do this show on each and every Friday. It will be coming to you. And some of you guys that have already followed and subscribed, you get it a little bit early on Thursday. So if you haven't followed or subscribed yet, please go ahead and do that. And you'll be able to get access to the show, the early bird special, if you will. But that does it for us for this week. And make sure you guys always tell the truth.
And nothing but the truth. And remember, guys, the truth always comes out.
We out.
Later, y'all.